happy Labor Day again to everyone. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. We're going to talk birds today with our guest, Bill Volker, back with us once more, a retired wildlife DNR educator, naturalist. He's worked at Hork and Marsh for 27 years, been watching birds for over 40 years, and he has sighted well over 3,600 species of birds. Can you believe it? Well, he knows a lot about birds, obviously, and maybe you have some questions about birds. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. If you've got some great bird photos, I hope you'll post those up as well on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And Bill Volker, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. Always great to be with you.
Always great to turn on the right microphone for you, too. Oh, my goodness. It's Labor Day. You know, my mind is here, but sometimes it flits off, you know, like the birds do. Migrating right now, we're getting some warblers coming through right now. Mm-hmm. But this whole thing about migration, I think, is really interesting because there's been a lot of pretty cool research done over the last few years that has come up with some nice surprising findings, I think.
Absolutely. And we're starting to learn things about birds that not only did we know before, but I think things we didn't even expect that birds were capable of. If we just go back a little in history, people have known about bird migration for a long, long time, just simply that observation of the coming and going of birds with the seasons. But our attempt to explain what was going on behind that was always kind of shrouded in myth and a lot of misunderstanding and confusion. Aristotle at one time said, well, we see these different birds at different times of the year because there's a transformation. They change from one kind to the next. That's why we see that. There also was a story about the barnacle goose, which is a European goose species. It got its name because some people thought they hung from trees the way barnacles would cling to rocks, or others thought, well, we see them on the water and fall, and then they just disappear all of a sudden. So they must dive under the water and turn into barnacles and then come back in spring. So there was all kinds of crazy ideas. There was even a French naturalist who in the 1700s said, well, I know, the birds actually pick up and they leave, and they all fly to the moon, and it takes 60 days to get there. So there were a lot
of... Well, they had the migration part, right? But yeah, not the wrong location.
What also astounded me is, you know, we knew that there were these distant continents, and it was a big world ever since Columbus and Magellan, but it wasn't until the early 1800s when the European naturalists were starting to venture into Africa and describe not just new species, but also recognizing, hey, those are the same birds we see in summertime. So by about that time, that early 1800s, we started to recognize these birds were going south, going to places that hadn't yet really been explored. Well, all that time, the intervening time since then, it's been trying to understand where do they go, how long does it take, and more recently, how do changes in land here and in the wintering ground affect the populations. So probably the best way really for us still to observe and to study migration is get your binoculars and just watch that passage of birds as they're coming and going. And especially today with the computer-based observation, the eBird, the electronic bird checklists, birders are logging their sightings. You've got the date, the time, and the location, and you can geocode that with the map. So if you were to look at eBird right now, take a look, for example, at Tennessee Warbler, a bird that nests in Canada. We're seeing them coming through Wisconsin, and there's also sightings now already into the central and a few into the southern states. And pretty soon we'll see people logging them arriving on the Caribbean islands. So we're actually can now see from enough people who are logging in kind of real time the movement of birds. So observation is still one of the key things and the best way for most of us to enjoy it. The big tool that has long really given us a lot of information on bird migration has been bird banding. And that is a technique to capture the bird, put a little ring on it with a number, and let it go. The very first record of banding of a bird in North America was the famous painter, John James Audubon.
Yeah.
Caught a little Phoebe that was nesting by his house, put a silver wire around its leg, and sure enough, the exact same bird was back the next spring. So we've known for a long time that general understanding that birds come back to where they nested. And that's from banding studies, because every Phoebe, every Robin, they all look alike. So how do we sort out individuals and who's who? We mark them. The shortcoming, though, of a banding is you've got to catch the same bird again. So we do learn things, for example, of how long they live. How often do these birds keep coming back to the same place? And what is the longevity, average, and also the exceptional life records for these birds? And occasionally, an individual may be caught down south somewhere, and so we get an idea of where those birds are going. The real breakthrough came then when we started developing the miniaturized electronics and were able to put radio transmitters on birds. The problem originally was that the electronics were large and always the battery to power that meant that we were restricted to putting them on larger birds. But we could actually now track their movement, but somebody had to follow them. More recently, with more powerful electronics, we're able to put these transmitters on birds and have them bounce the signals off of satellites. You get the GPS locations, and we can see where they're going. That's what they did back up, I think it was in 2007, with the bar-tailed godwit, a large sandpiper that nests mm-hmm. in Alaska and winters down in New Zealand along the coast. And the populations have been declining. So we're wondering, where are these big stopover points? What do we need to protect in between? And how can we help them? It absolutely blew everyone away when we realized they don't stop. These birds will pick up from Alaska, go nonstop, fly the entire length of the Pacific, will go for 7 to 9 days without ever stopping. They can't
swim. It's just amazing.
Nobody expected that. And even for myself, as much as I've been studying birds, I didn't think they're even capable of that. There was another study that came out just last summer of a large seabird called the frigate bird. If you've ever been down along the Gulf Coast or some of the islands out in the Pacific, you've probably seen frigate birds, very large black birds, long swept-back wings. Well, we're wondering, where do they spend their night? We don't see them sitting on the water. We've never had any reports of it. They just found what they do is they'll fly out, look for rising air currents over the ocean. They'll sail up 15,000 to 18,000 feet, hang there for the night, and sort of half fall asleep, and in the morning come back down.
Oh, wow. Is that cool?
So we're learning things that we had never expected. The other two big developments very recently have been geolocators, and another one I'll mention real quickly called MODIS, and if anybody's interested, check that out. Geolocators differ from transmitters. It's just a little chip that we put on birds, which means tiny songbirds, where you can't put a whole radio transmitter and battery pack to last for years, we can put this chip on. And what it does is it records the hours of sun exposure and the angle of the sun. From that, you can figure out the latitude and longitude of where that bird's been. Like a bird band, you catch the bird, fix it to it, and you have to catch the same individual. Now, if you catch them on the nesting ground, chances are they're coming back to the same place. And we also know that most of these birds find a territory on the wintering grounds and return there as well. In 2011, I was in Nicaragua again, and I worked with some researchers from Canada who were studying wood thrushes, catching them on the wintering ground and fixing these geolocators. And then the researchers down there would catch them the following year and mail it back. You can download the data, and you can actually then find all these points of the exact course that bird is using. And what they found for the wood thrushes, they captured them in Belize, in Costa Rica, and in northern Nicaragua, was that these different populations are actually nesting in different parts of the eastern United States. So in other words, they're not just going south.
Right.
But Wisconsin wood thrushes may be going to one very discreet region in the tropics, different from, say, New York or birds of the Appalachians. And so we now realize that some of these birds have some real true courses.
That is very, very cool. You mentioned a large black bird when you were talking, Bill, and we got an email from Joel. She says, any idea what species is this large black bird? It's about 14 inches tall when running. I spotted it this morning in Madison, and it was running, and then it went into hiding. And the picture isn't completely...
Yeah, I'm trying to take a look. It's got a bluish eye ring to it and a very stout bill. That short bill, to me, looks like something of the quail family. And so my guess would be this. It's very likely something from a game farm.
Yeah.
Also, I do not recognize as all black a typical species of that member. But when birds are kept in captivity, we sometimes will breed them for different colors. So yeah. The pure white, say, of turkeys, not a natural color, but the domestic has it, the black that we'll see, these are usually game farm birds. Looks like an escapee.
Yeah, that's...
Probably something, I would say, of the quail-grouse family. And this guy's head turned a little bit, so I can't see. But there are a lot of close members of that found throughout the world. So very likely something from perhaps a European species.
Bill Volkert, our guest, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. It's great to have him along. We're talking about fall bird watching. And you can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. And, well, let's listen to here's a bird song. That's one. You know that bird.
You'll recognize it by the pattern.
Yeah.
It's a very rapid, chatty call. It has this up and down, kind of a zigzag mm-hmm. pattern, and almost always ends rising up. So you hear this up and down, up and down, and up and down, and then rising and at the end. Warbling vireo. And it is that warbling is that sort of up, down, very melodic type of a call. Vireos, we've got about a half a dozen species in Wisconsin. This is one of the more common ones, but it is so drab. It has no real field marks to it. There's no ring or stripe to the eye. It's just a faint little eyebrow or a little stripe by the eye. Has no wing bars. The color above is sort of a grayish green down below, a little bit lighter, and that's it. But the song is very diagnostic. I just had one yesterday singing by the house. So birds don't sing as much this time of year. It's not the nesting season. They will sometimes throw out a bit of a song. And right now, most of these birds are busy feeding and fuel loading because they're going to be picking up in the next few weeks and heading out.
Yeah, and the warblers are now coming through the state.
Yes, there have been some really good reports of warblers. A fellow up in Ashland, Ryan Brady, who watches birds up there, had in single day 20 species. People on some of the hikes around in Madison, Milwaukee, Green Bay area have been reporting some nice variety of 10, 15 species of warblers in a single day. The problem, though, with warblers right now is most of them don't have their breeding colors, so they're really drab, and the leaves are still really abundant in the trees.
Yeah, they're hard to see.
And a little 4-inch bird has a lot of hiding space, and as an active feeder, it's hard to peer through the leaves and then with those muted colors to see enough for positive identification. It's one of the big challenges for bird watchers. And you'll see most field guides, they'll actually have a page, what they call Confusing Fall Warblers, very well named.
Bill in Sturgeon Bay has a question. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live south of Sturgeon Bay, about 9 miles.
Mm-hmm.
I've been feeding any birds that will come around, but I really have a specific interest in the hummingbirds, and I've read so many different books on when they leave, when they come back. And I'm wondering, what do they go by like any type of a solstice or something like that, or is it a temperature change that causes them to, well, either to come back or to mm-hmm. come to this area? Or specifically, when do they generally leave? Is there a definite time because of this, the angle of the sun, or do they go by the temperature, or what?
Excellent question. The general stimulus for bird migration is the day length. And so right now, days are getting shorter. And for anybody who works a day shift job, you notice that there aren't a lot of hours left anymore before sunset. So the birds recognize that as well. And so as these days shorten up, that's the trigger for them to get ready for migration. The actual day they leave is usually with the passing of a cold front. They sense that through the changes in the barometric pressure. And with that, the winds are going to shift out of the north. And so they're going to ride those winds. Most of our birds migrate at night. So they'll be actively feeding during the day and then in the evening time, ride those winds and head south. Now, for hummingbirds, a lot of people say, this has been a bit of a myth out there, take your feeder down because if you leave it out too long, you're going to keep them here. They'll feel stranded and then they're going to run out of food and die. Well, if the day length is what's the migration trigger for them, the shortage of food has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Leave your feeder up, because they're actually going to depend on that food even more at this time while the flowers are starting to fade, and they'll pick up and go on their own. Those hummingbirds that remain exceptionally late, we usually think there's something wrong. There's some sort of a physical or physiological problem. They're just not in good shape to be able to head out, and it's not your feeder that's keeping them here. So, yeah, keep the feeder up, and they'll be leaving now through September. This is normally the time they'll be picking up. I've got them battling at my feeders. There's one dominant bird out there. They're chasing them around, but everybody's trying to get in and get a little bit of food when they can, and you'll see in the next couple of weeks, all of a sudden, they'll start to thinning out.
Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. I'm Larry Mueller. Nyasia Ellison, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Visiting about birds now with Bill Volkert, a naturalist. It's great to have him back. He comes by often on our holidays. And we will go right back to the phone and to Keith in Edgar. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I was wondering, where do turkey vultures go in winter?
Okay, good question. I'll give you a one-word answer, south.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, here's a problem.
We go to Texas often in the late fall, just to kind of extend our fall.
Mm-hmm.
You never see them there either.
Okay. The problem with knowing exactly where Wisconsin turkey vultures go is the fact that there are year-round resident turkey vultures all through the southern United States and even throughout central and northern South America. So, in other words, it's not like, say, Baltimore Orioles, that somebody in Central America sees them disappear and all of a sudden they show up by us and then ours disappear and they arrive in those countries. Because they have permanent residents, resident populations, it's hard to know where our birds go. Are they just going down to the southern U.S.? Are they going further into Mexico? The only way to know that for sure would be to actually capture them and mark them. One of the problems with marking turkey vultures is that traditional leg banding, you can't do that. Turkey vultures not only have a somewhat disgusting diet by eating on the dead carcasses, but also other disgusting habits, which includes defending their nest by throwing up on people. And to cool themselves on summer days, they'll oftentimes let their droppings run down their leg, which then acts like perspiration. The problem with the leg band is that the calcium in there starts to build up and clump on it. So we have tried what they call patagial tags, little flags that go on the wings. But it requires, again, a focused study of somebody to really say, I'm going to look at Wisconsin vultures and try to track where they go. I think the best guess, since we don't have actual data of individuals from here to cite them where they're heading to, is that they're probably going down to the southern U.S. and perhaps into northern Mexico and probably not much farther than that, though we will see other turkey vultures further south. I think those are the resident populations, or maybe a shift even from some of those birds from the southern U.S. Retreating a little bit with the season. If you're looking for carcasses as your main food, just get down far enough where you don't have severe winter weather that's covering up the food. So
yeah, there you go.
Central and southern states is probably where they're heading to.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I want to go to Facebook for a minute because we've got a beautiful photo here from Deb of a yellow-headed blackbird in southern Chippewa County this spring.
Very nice photo, and always an extremely colorful bird. The yellow-headed blackbird is a bird of the wetland, somewhat deeper cattail marshes. Their main range is in the prairie pothole region of the north-central United States. So the Dakotas, that area where we also have the big duck nesting, is an area with a rolling prairie and scattered wetlands, and that's really sort of the central area where the yellow-headed blackbird nesting range is. But we do have this spillover of birds into Wisconsin, and if you take a look at the range map, they'll actually show a little loop, so to speak, coming into Wisconsin, and it's these bigger marshes along the Mississippi River, the backwaters. Down by Madison, there's a number of deeper wetlands where these birds are traditional. Horicon Marsh, always a place for them. And from there and a couple of wetlands into Illinois is the only real extent of nesting for the yellow-headed blackbird east of the Mississippi River.
All right, really interesting. Bill Volkert, our guest. As you're listening, you might want to take a look at the photo that Deb sent. It's on Facebook. It's on the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. And click on posts over on the left side of the page. And then over on the right side of the page, that's where the visitor posts are. And you'll be able to see that along with some, Kathy sent a nice photo of a couple of eagles. Looks like a recent photo near Whitehall, Wisconsin.
And that's a bird that I think people may remember. It was always that trip up north to try to find an eagle and hopefully see one. And now they're statewide.
Everywhere.
They're everywhere. They've made an incredible comeback. And it's no longer an uncommon sight to see them in almost every county in the state.
Billy in Rochester, it's your turn. Thanks for calling.
Nice show.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
The other morning I got up, and it was about 6:30 in the morning, and I happened to look up, and there was thousands and thousands of birds flying from the northwest to the southeast. And I'm talking thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And it lasted for probably, I'm saying, 4 or 5 minutes. They just kept coming and coming and coming. They looked about as big as a robin with a fan tail, and they didn't have any hop to them. It was just a straight flight, and they were a dark-colored bird.
My guess would be grackles. The blackbirds right now are flocking in some big numbers. So red-winged blackbirds and grackles, they're close relatives. They'll form some pretty big flocks. They're usually late migrants when they retreat. Grackles will leave before the red wings. We actually will have a few individuals that may, or even flocks, that remain through the wintertime if they can find food. But what's happening right now is the birds, some of them are actually in passage. They're moving. So as Larry mentioned earlier, the warblers, some of the thrushes, these birds are starting to move through the state, and some of the summer birds are departing. So our Baltimore Orioles, a lot of those are leaving. Nighthawks was a nice big migration in the last 2 weeks. A lot of people were seeing those around the state. Other birds like sandhill cranes, red-winged blackbirds, grackles, and Canada geese, these are birds that will be leaving very late in the year, but what we're seeing right now is the forming of the flocks and more local movements between places where they're roosting at night and where they're going out to feed. So one of the confusions oftentimes, I used to get this at Horicon Marsh from people, is what's wrong with these birds? I got up this morning, there were thousands of geese, and they're all going north. I thought it's fall migration. Mm-hmm. Well, that was just a feeding flight. That was a local movement of birds, not the actual migration. So as I said earlier, most of these birds, when they're actually departing, are flying at night. These movements during the day are these flocks that are moving around to look for the food resources.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Billy.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Speaking of that, we were out for a walk. Emily and I were out for kind of a walk yesterday afternoon in the Cottage Grove area, and probably got within, maybe 20 feet of a half a dozen sandhill cranes.
Oh, yes, yeah. And that's what you're seeing now are these flocks are forming. So sandhill cranes, when they first... there you go.
Yeah, there they are.
Yes, and we'll be hearing that as these flocks are in the marshes and out in the fields. Very common call. A bird that has really made a tremendous comeback.
Very cool.
Real music, isn't it? Yeah, back in the 1930s, Aldo Leopold, the famous ecologist, did his own little survey of sandhill cranes and estimated that maybe only 300 remained in Wisconsin he could find. It was a population that had really been devastated up to that point, and it's been a very slow recovery. They started coming back in good numbers in the 80s, and then in the 90s and 2000s, we saw a continued large growth of them. So now we find them statewide. And so during the nesting season, they're scattered around, and then become very quiet. And so we have individual pairs here and there. And as the young are maturing in midsummer, they start taking flight, and then they will now start to form into flocks, and you'll see them actually shift in the state to what we call staging areas. So some of the bigger marshes around the state are places where the flocks will form. This is where they'll roost at night and then fly out to feed. And they won't leave until pretty late in the year. I usually see them heading out in late October into November, and very commonly over Thanksgiving and the deer hunting season. If there's a good cold north wind, the cranes will be flying over. Some of them will stick around about as late as they can.
Very interesting.
So right now, we've got almost 2 months yet of these local flocking and movement of cranes in the state.
Pauline in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Pauline.
Oh, good morning. I was wondering when I should head for Duluth, Superior, or Superior, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. to see the raptors migrate.
Okay. Usually in that mid-late September, we'll start to see some movement of them and into our early mid-October. Those are some of the big times for the hawk migration. And, of course, these are the hawks coming out of Canada. They hit Lake Superior. They don't like to go over that big open water. So they'll funnel along that north shore, and you get by Duluth, and it literally is that funnel where the flocks are coming together and kind of slip around that far western edge. And some great observation up there. And the Minnesota Ornithological Union does have regular observation. They have counters up there, people who have keep tally of the hawks, and then there's always going to be some field trips from the different bird clubs going up to join them. You may want to check some of the websites of the bird clubs up in that area and to see when they have an outing, because it's one thing to see the birds, another to have an expert next to you and point out which is which and what they're looking for and which ones come through a little earlier and a little bit later on. We also get a fairly similar migration down along the Lake Michigan shoreline.
Okay, thank you. You're
yeah, welcome. Thanks a lot for calling. Lee in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, good morning. I'd like to ask Bill, where have our bobolinks and our meadowlarks went? And especially, where can I even go in the state to see a bobolink anymore?
Oh, good question. The bobolinks have departed already for the year. The problem for both of those is they were birds of the original prairies. So at one time when the whole central portion of the United States from the Rocky Mountains to Wisconsin was grassland, there was plenty of habitat. What happened was with the advent of settlement and modern agriculture, they moved into what the ecologists call surrogate grasslands. In other words, not a native prairie, but pasture land, fallow fields, those kinds of areas that provided a similar structure. In other words, medium height grasses and open landscape that was very attractive. The problem came for them with some of the newer developments in agriculture, which was a lot of the clover plantings. And what happens there is, and I talked to farmers from their end to find out what's going on. They say it's important, especially for the milk cows, to get them over to some good greens and high nutrition in early spring. And so the clovers are really important that way. The problem for the bobolink is that clover is just the right height in springtime that's very attractive for the kind of habitat they're looking for. And they're kind of a late arrival. They'll get here in that early mid part of May. They're just starting to select mates and settle down for nesting. And the first clover cutting is always right around Memorial Day. So they're just into the height of that nesting season. And without enough fallow fields out there remaining throughout most of June into early July, a lot of these are not able to pull off a brood of young. So it's what the ecologists call a habitat sink. In other words, what happens is the mortality exceeds reproduction. Populations decline because you lure them in there, but they're not replacing themselves. So it's really been land use changes. Conservation Reserve Program, CRP, was a real boom for them. Here we had a permanent grass structure, grass cover that was out there as we fallowed land. Now a lot of that has been plowed under because of corn prices being high and ethanol demand. Now, hopefully, with some of the abundance in fossil fuels, maybe ethanol is not as attractive. I'm not sure where corn prices are these days. Maybe some of that is being set aside again. But it's directly related to the amount of grassland habitat. You've got a lot of grassland, you'll have a lot of grassland birds. We see changes in our land use, and that declines, so do the populations. Also, bobolinks are an interesting bird because they're so grassland dependent. They've got a very long migration. They're not able to winter just on the southern United States. Where the coastal plains, we do have some grassland areas. It's not suitable for them. So they continue south, and now they run into rainforest. They fly over the entire Amazon and winter in Argentina in the Pampas. So a very long migration for a songbird. A grassland down there in Argentina, and our grasslands up here is where they nest.
There we go. Thank you so much, Lee, for calling. Doc in Big Cedar Lake, your turn. Hi, Doc.
Good morning, Larry and Bill.
Hi, Doc. Nice to hear from you.
Good to talk to you, Bill. I'm seeing something around Big Cedar Lake that I haven't seen before, and that is wild turkey chicks in the month of August, even in late August last mm-hmm. week. And my son was driving through Manches the other day, and he saw what he thought was a group of grouse crossing the road. And then, of course, a mother turkey was with them, and he realized they were turkey chicks. Is this unusual for them to have litters this late in the summer?
It is unusual, but I think it's probably a little bit more common only because we have so many turkeys out there. In other words, probably a very small percentage of them will have a brood that late into the summer. But when you've got an awful lot of turkeys, there's a chance that somebody may just encounter something out there this time of year. Now, turkeys, for the most part, are single-brooded. They'll raise one family of young because it takes a lot of attention to those young to raise them to full size. But they will try more than once if there's a nest failure. So one of the biggest problems is nest predation, particularly raccoons. The hen will pick up and leave, but if the raccoon gets in, it'll destroy the nest. It takes a while for the hen then to build up some reserves and try to lay another brood. We see the same with ducks. They'll raise only one family in a year, but often in that mid-late summer, you'll see the ducklings of different sizes, which is different times when they hatched. So in other words, everybody will try early in spring to raise a family. If they're unsuccessful, they'll try again. And usually what happens is the number of eggs they lay later in summer is less because they just haven't got that body fat and reserves to devote to egg production. And so what you really have, I'm guessing here, is just a bird that was unsuccessful and thought, well, there's a little bit of summer left. Try one more time and see if it can't raise some family before it gets too late in the year.
Yeah, mm-hmm. There we go, Doc.
Thanks for your comments.
Yeah, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Just to Facebook for a minute again, because Kathy posted a really nice photo.
Oh, beautiful.
Of a white-crowned sparrow. This is near Whitehall, Wisconsin. And Kathy says, we don't see these very often, and they're a really pretty bird.
It is one of our more spectacular sparrows, and you don't see them that often because they nest right on the edge of the tree line, on the edge of the Arctic tundra. And so it is what we call a passage migrant in Wisconsin. We only see them when they're coming and going. And so usually in the first 2 weeks of May or so is when they show up. And they'll be feeding, usually in open grassland areas, around feeders sometimes. And then they'll pick up and leave, go to the nesting grounds in Canada. And coming back through the fall time, they don't seem to stick around real late in the fall or for very long time. It's not, from my experience, a real common sighting. So very nice and an excellent photo.
Yeah, an excellent photo. And if you, it doesn't look at all like what you might think of as a sparrow, for sure. So if you go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mealer Show and take a look at it, it's really a really pretty bird. Let's go to Bill in Appleton next. Bill, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. We were kayaking, circumnavigating Rock Island Saturday,
mm-hmm.
and we were first watching a bald eagle, and then we looked in the shore, and I swear we saw a magpie.
Wonderful sighting for Wisconsin.
I thought it was way out of the range, and I pointed it to another paddler, and he immediately said magpie.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're right, but...
Yes, and it's not a common sighting at all. There was a post that I saw of a magpie sighting a few weeks ago in Wisconsin. I forget the location right now. Interestingly, that with the internet these days and so many birders out there posting sightings for a rare bird, sometimes we'll actually find what we believe to be the same individual sighted in a couple of different locations as it's moving around. Just something that stands out. We do have a number of records of black-billed magpie in Wisconsin, but it's not very common. You're right about that. It's a forest edge bird. So once you cross over that whole central part of the United States and get to the Rocky Mountains, you'll see them from there all the way to the West Coast. Interestingly, there also are black-billed magpies in Europe and into northern Asia. But the only place that they're not found in that whole northern portion of the world is the eastern United States. So we are basically separated by the prairies. It makes it difficult for a bird like that, which is not migratory. They tend to be year-round residents out west, for an odd one just to pick up on a wind and fly over here. As I say, we've had a number of sightings, I'd say probably every 3 or 4 years, something like that, that we get a record of one in Wisconsin. But it's a bird I've never seen in Wisconsin itself. I've never chased after it. But, unusual for us. If you're looking for them, drive west. You'll see them. Great sighting. Yeah, thanks for sharing that.
Thanks a lot for calling, Bill. I appreciate it. Renee in the Cedar, it's your turn. Hi, Renee.
Hi.
What have we got for us?
I have a place over by the refuge, and it's called the Cedar Refuge.
Mm-hmm.
And this last fall, I got to see two whooping cranes. And I was told that there's only 14 in the wild right now. So that was pretty rewarding to see two of them in nice health and as close as we were.
Yes, a very nice sighting.
The refuge is a very nice area. They have a climbing tower, and mm-hmm. you can see birds coming in and nesting and dancing and just enjoying the marshlands very much.
Yeah.
Excellent
it
sighting.
It is a nice refuge.
Let me add just a little bit to the whooping crane. Actually, 14... I've also read 15 is the number that they were down to by the 1940s. There were only that few remaining in the wild at that time. That's when we started a national program to try to recover it, and it still remains as an endangered species. The entire population has grown to over, well, somewhere around 250 birds or so in the Western flock, which is the original wild flock nesting in southern Canada, right by the British Columbia northern border, and then going down to Texas coast. The big fear was that we had, as the old adage is, all your eggs in one basket. We had all of the wild birds in one single wild population. And if there were any sort of an epidemic, pollution, you know, say an oil spill on the Texas coast at the wrong time, anything like that, we would could possibly endanger an entire population. So we began to introduce them into Wisconsin. Nisida is the place where we first started. And this year they actually had several pair that were nesting. They've always had a real challenge with the black flies. We have another release out at Horicon and up at the White River Marsh in Green Lake County. That's another place where they've been releasing birds, try to bolster that population.
Very good. Thank you, Renee. Let's go to Molly in Duluth, Minnesota next. Hi, Molly.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. I just heard that person call in asking about hawk migration.
Yes.
And Hawk Ridge Bird Observatory is a place to go.
Mm-hmm.
It overlooks the city. It's run by Hawk Ridge Bird Observatory, a nonprofit. And there's staff on hand right now that can help people identify the birds that are going over. And people can come and go to different programs and learn all about hawk migration over Duluth.
Excellent. Is there a website that people can go to figure out exactly the location and hours?
Yes, everything's on there, including the daily hawk count. It's hawkridge.org.
Excellent.
Hawkridge.org.
Right.
That'll help answer a lot better questions than I could.
Thank you, Molly.
I knew you were up there. I appreciate you calling in.
Thanks, Molly. Niaja, maybe you can get that up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, that link. What was it again? It was
Hawkridge.org.
Hawkridge.org.
Yes.
All right. Let's go to Rod in Weyerhaeuser next. Rod, hello.
Hello, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment, you know, it's been since in the mid-90s when we quit making hay. We had 67 acres, you know, under plow. And, of course, towards last, that's all we did was just make hay.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, used to see bobolinks all the time. And in reference to what that previous man said, he don't see bobolinks anymore. You know, you used to see them once in a while in the swamps because, you know, we live up here in this rock country up in the Blue Hills. And wherever the swamps were, my grandpa, I guess in the late 20s, 30s, put that canary grass. And I think that's where the bobolinks were staying. But anyhow, my nephew was going to rent the field, and he just didn't do it, so it sat for 3 years. And that thing grew up. The whole field grew up in goldenrods and thistle and you name it. There was all kinds of milkweed. And when I would go out there, by God, I was seeing bobolinks, and I was seeing a lot of finch. And, you know, all these things came back just because it left standing for like 3 years. But I also was going to make a point that, in all honesty, you know, a lot of these birds that we're talking about that you were talking that disappeared, you know, none of it really was natural if you think about it, because when this was all virgin pine, how many of those things, those birds were actually here anyhow?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We had
prairie that was in the southern part of Wisconsin, and especially in the western portion of the state. So kind of a line coming down from, say, Eau Claire area and sweeping through south of Stevens Point and over toward Racine. That southwestern part of the state was the original grassland, interspersed with oak forests. So that's where those grassland birds were, but the main population out in the prairies west of us. And obviously, as we change the land, we've benefited some birds and others. You know, you always have winners and losers. And so that's really what we find is that the birds are subject to land use changes. For those who do have grasslands, the general rule of thumb is if you can delay your mowing till at least the 1st of July, and even better yet, middle or end of July, that'll give those birds a chance to raise the family for the year. Sometimes there are, of course, economic conflicts with that. But if you've got some land that doesn't need to be mowed necessarily, but you are planning on doing it, yeah, wait until mid-July if you can possibly. That'll give those birds that are there a chance to raise a family for the year.
And, Rod, thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at birds and fall migration on the Ideas Network program today, the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator. He has more than 3,600 species that he has sighted, which, Bill, that's a lot of birds.
There's birds wherever you go.
My goodness, that's more. I didn't even know there were that many, but that's a pretty large number, but still not touching the total.
No, we estimate about 10,300 species of birds in the world. We could go on for a long time about the problem with that, which is it depends on who's classifying them. We don't always know for some of these birds where to really draw the line, whether the variation we see in these populations is just subspecies or so we should elevate that to species level. Some people have developed checklists that are over 11,000. Depends on how you want to slice and dice and classify them. But I would say roughly, say, 10,000 species. And so far, I've seen a little over a third of those, which means I got a lot more to go.
There we go. And speaking of seeing things, I know a few people have called and saying, where the heck on the Facebook page are all those pictures? If you go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, then look down the left side, that far left column, you'll come to something that says posts, and click on the posts, and that will sort of ignite over on the right side the listener posts. And then just go over to the right side of the page and click on listener posts. And there they'll pop up. And sometimes they'll pop up right in the middle of the page, too, under the comments section. So you can look there as well. And as Tricia sent us a nice photo of an owl here.
That's barred owl. Very nice picture, sitting in a spruce tree.
Yeah.
And barred owl is one of our more common owls. Great horned owl, barred owl, and the little screech owl are the three most common, very widespread. This one is easily recognized by the rounded head, does not have the ear tufts, and also dark eyes, where most of our owls have yellow eyes.
Yeah, very pretty bird.
Mm-hmm.
And a nice photo. Let's go to Bob in Appleton next. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I just got a quick question for the other expert on the line. Is there a field guide to birds that you would recommend that may focus or maybe entirely dedicate to the birds in Wisconsin?
A good question. There are state guides that have been developed. A fellow by the name of Dan Tekla had put together different books for each state, and Birds of Wisconsin is a small field guide. It's been a while since I've thumbed through it. It's got all of the common birds for Wisconsin, yeah, but not, say, exclusive of every single species. So if you're looking for a beginner guide, it's really nice because it doesn't confuse you with a lot of things that are not that common that you may not see. So if someone's just getting started in birding, these are really nice because it'll help you to get a little bit of an eye for it and weed out and identify some of the most common birds.
And again, that's called
Birds of Wisconsin.
And Tekla is the author.
If you're looking for something more comprehensive, there are a lot of different field guides out there. The Peterson Guide, Sibley, National Geographic, Stokes, a lot of different authors and publishers have field guides to birds. What my recommendation is, if you can get into a bookstore and actually thumb through them, take a look at the illustrations and how it's laid out to see which of those really you can relate to best. Every author or publisher has a little different way of illustrating the birds, and some of them are sometimes a little easier for some people to relate to than others. I like Peterson. I think he was a really good artist.
Yeah.
Now, there may be some birds that are more common in the southern United States. Then you want to take a look at a list of Wisconsin birds. You can get that from the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, website wsobirds.com. .org. And if you go there, you'll get the Wisconsin total list, and then you can take a look and kind of highlight in your book which are the expected birds for Wisconsin and weed a few of those out.
Yeah.
Best recommendation I have.
Really appreciate the information.
And Bob, if I don't know what another kind of fun thing to do is to go out with a birder, somebody who's really knows their birds. I tell you, I've been out with a few experts, and it is so much fun to be with somebody who really knows the background. Well, like somebody like Bill here, but in Appleton, I'm not sure. I'm sure there's a bird club in Appleton.
There's one in Oshkosh and one in Green Bay. Yeah. You can always check around for the different bird clubs or your nature centers. And so that Appleton area of Gordon Bubel Center, Thousand Islands, over by New London, there's another one there, Mosquito Hill. So any of those, they've all got their bird hikes, and that'll also really help you to go out with somebody who knows them and help to point them out and what to look for. It'll save you a lot of frustration of thumbing through a guide that's got 500-600 different species and trying to figure out what you're looking at.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
You're
welcome. Thanks, Bob. Janice in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Janice.
I've been feeding my Baltimore Orioles all summer with jelly and orange slices, and now I haven't seen them for a day or two. Are they gone?
Interesting you should ask. There was a little discussion on the Wisconsin Birding Network, which is an online chat group, discussion group of bird sightings, and somebody asked the same question in the last week. A few people were still reporting Orioles around, others were not. So they are departing at this time. One of the problems with Baltimore Orioles is that in the middle of summer, natural food becomes very abundant. They're not always drawn to feeders, and they become very silent. So I know the Orioles are around all through spring and early summer just because I hear the chatter in the treetops. They're well camouflaged in that dense leaf cover overhead. But exactly when they disappear, sometimes we don't recognize that until a few days later, that in retrospect, like, yeah, I haven't seen them now, so they must have left. Yeah, and this is the time. They're pulling out.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. That's okay. I guess they have to go.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, two things. One, wait till the first week of May. They'll be back again in full color. The other opportunity, travel to the tropics. We'll be going to Central America. I'll be leading a hike, a tour down to Nicaragua. We'll see them on the wintering ground.
There you go.
Yeah, in fact, I'll make a quick mention. We do have openings yet for a cultural and natural history tour that we'll be doing February 4th to the 11th, 8-day tour in Nicaragua.
Oh,
everything's on my
cool
website at BillVolkert.com.
BillVolkert.com. We've got your website, I think, up on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. I just flipped on a video.
Very nice.
That Suzanne sent of a green heron fishing along the shore. The heron, there's a log that, or a branch that's out over the water, a few inches over the water, and that heron is really...
He'll just pose like that, just still. I mean, he's not moving one bit, and he's just going to wait for any movement, and he's just going to snap for it. There also was some interesting... I've seen two different clips of this where they try some fishing. I saw somebody was... green heron was taking little bits of, like, bread and something, throwing it out. The minnows come up for it, and then he snaps up the minnows. So they've learned to do that.
Very, very cool. Well, that thanks a lot,
very
Suzanne,
nice
for sending that.
Yeah, that's a great bird. And they'll be leaving now the next 2 to 3 weeks. September, they always leave right at sunset.
Ah, well, here's another email from Pat in East Troy, or I'm sorry, a phone call from Pat in East Troy. Pat, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for getting me on.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to tell you that I saw two pure white geese with two normal colored geese cruising along next to the shoreline on Lake Beulah last night.
Any black on them at all in the wingtips or anything?
None that I could see.
Okay. The reason I ask is in the more western states, the snow goose, we'll start seeing the first arrivals of that over the next couple of weeks. It's right now a little early for them. We may get a straggler or something that's showing up a little early. They usually come more into, say, very late September, October. And the most of that migration is west of the Mississippi, so a white goose with black in the wingtips. We also get albinism in birds, and it's just a matter of just genetic chance, the roll of the dice, but Canada geese are so abundant that albinism is a just better chance it's going to show up in there. And yes, we will have some Canada geese with all white plumage.
Oh, very good. Pat, thank you so much for calling. Our guest today, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. He worked at Horican Marsh for 27 years, or more than, actually. And he's been watching birds for 40 years. And he's with us till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back. Stay with us. Talking birds today on the program, Larry Mueller here. My guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. And always great to have him along. He comes by for a lot of our holiday programs, and it's always a lot of fun to talk about birds with him. You may have some questions. Call us at 800-642-1234, or maybe an experience to share. If you have a great photo, I hope you'll, or even a video, I hope you'll put it up on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. And you don't have to be a member of Facebook to view those things as well, I should point out. Just go to listener posts on the left side, click on that, and then over on the right side, the visitor posts pop up, and you'll be able to look at all the great photos and videos that have been sent so far. And Gary in Rhinelander has something for us, Bill, so let's go there. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Hey, I do a lot of traveling, and last week I was on the eastern shore of north of Marinette, and I seen like 12 to 15 white birds, and amongst them was also a sandhill crane. Now, I was just wondering if it was the whooping hill cranes, and if the sandhill crane seemed to be very communal. Because I've seen that with geese in fields as well.
Yeah, yep, you're absolutely right that if there is a suitable area as far as a feeding or a resting site and nobody's disturbing the birds, similar species will sometimes gather there. Just like any good marsh will have a variety of ducks, you can also find Canada geese and snow geese or even white-fronted geese mingling together. Occasionally, sandhill and whooping cranes will also find a very similar place. So, as we had the caller earlier from Nisida National Wildlife Refuge, this is a site where they've been releasing and rearing the whooping crane, and also they have a lot of sandhills. And occasionally they will mingle together. We've even had a few instances where they've been trying to pair together, which for an endangered species you don't want to see. Find someone of your own kind to keep the pure genetic strain there. But they'll oftentimes just mingle in a suitable area.
There's a great photo of it up on our Facebook page now.
Very nice.
Linda sent one of some sandhills and some geese right together, walking in a little marsh area, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's see, what else have we got here?
A saur rail. Very nice picture.
Yeah, there's a Laura sent us a great shot from the Broughton Sheboygan Marsh State Wildlife Area. And what's that bird again?
This is the saura. It's a marshland bird. The rails tend to have these oversized feet. They actually work like snowshoes, so they can walk on floating vegetation between the cattails or along the edge. It's a bird that, in a suitable marsh, the bigger cattail marshes, are fairly common if you can listen for them in spring. But trying to get a sighting or certainly a photo is hard because they slip back just, say, more than a foot into the cattails. They're just vanish from sight.
See them.
So, yeah, very nice photo, very lucky sighting.
And that's a, and if you look at that bird, it's kind of, I'd say, a gray and brown with a brighter chicken-like beak.
There are two subgroups of the rails. They're both marsh birds with these big feet. The true rails, like Virginia rail and King rail, have elongated beaks. This one with a little triangular beak. In Europe, they call them crakes. So we used to call this Sora rail. We now just refer to it as a Sora because technically it's a rail family, but he's not a rail. He's a crake.
So. There we go. Joan and
that little chicken-like look. Yes.
Joan and Madison, your turn.
Yes, don't ever retire, Larry.
Thanks. I'll try not to.
I was out watering my garden this morning and missed the first part of your show, and someone called in about hummingbirds. Mm-hmm. I have hummingbirds, and I was wondering if you could repeat if they're still around and when they migrate and what kind of hummingbird we have in Wisconsin, and I'll listen off of the radio.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the main hummingbird we have in Wisconsin and the eastern United States is the ruby throat. The males have the ruby throat. The females and young have a grayish-colored throat. We will occasionally get some western hummingbirds that will slip into Wisconsin, especially in the later part of the migration. The rufous hummingbird has been one that's been sighted fairly often in the last few years, and occasionally Anna's hummingbird. So these are birds that will sometimes show up at feeders. This is the time of year. The next couple of weeks, the hummingbirds will be picking up and leaving. As we mentioned earlier, leave your feeders out. They'll take advantage of that food to fuel up, and they'll be leaving on their own. But you'll see them disappear over the next couple of weeks.
And thanks again. Vivian, your turn now from Dykesville. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. We have the American white pelican on the bay, Green mm-hmm. Bay. And we will also often see them in the spring and then again in the fall as they're migrating. They fly, you know, as you know, very close to the water. Well, we see them with thousands of cormorants. They mm-hmm. seem to travel quite a bit with cormorants. My question is, where do the pelicans go during the winter time?
Okay.
Where are they migrating?
Yes, they're heading to the southern U.S. around the Gulf Coast. Some will remain in the larger inland bodies in the southern U.S. and some right along the coastal area. If you get down to the Gulf Coast, there's a second species, the brown pelican, that remains there year-round. They're not only different colors. Ours, of course, the white pelican being the light color, brown pelican, well-named for its brown, but they also have different feeding strategies. The white pelican will move along in flocks, and they'll actually herd or school the fish, and then with that big bucket mouth, just scoop up as they kind of corner the fish. So they're looking for the forage schooling fish. Cormorants tend to chase fish individually, but they're both looking for, obviously, increased odds with schooling fish. The brown pelican, you'll see those off the coast and sometimes in the nature specials, they'll look for the larger shoals of fish in the coastal waterways, and then they dive from the air after them. White pelicans don't do that.
Yeah. There we
have you any information about whether or not the American whites and their numbers have diminished up in our area? Because we don't seem to be seeing them quite as prevalent as we did, let's say, 10 years ago, mm-hmm. 8 years ago.
Good question. Actually, the overall trend of pelicans in Wisconsin has been a big increase. We've always had some sightings in Wisconsin, but these were non-breeders. They don't breed until they're about 4 to 6 years old. And so the main population nests west of the Mississippi in that prairie pothole region, those big wetlands in the north central part of the U.S. Wisconsin were just off to the side of that, but they started showing up in the 1990s. The first nesting was in Green Bay, Cat Island, then Horicon Marsh, then Lake Butamore out in Mississippi. We actually have a number of colonies, but they are colonial nesters. So you'll have all the pelicans in the neighborhood nesting in one large area. Because they don't nest until they're, say, 4 or 5 years old or so, you also have flocks of non-breeders. The last couple of years, Sheboygan has been reporting some really big flocks of pelicans throughout the summer. No evidence of nesting there, but that's where the young are hanging out.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much for calling, Vivian. Appreciate your call. Sharon in Appleton emailed us, wonders if you can comment on the best time to visit Horicon Marsh to view the fall bird migrations.
I would say start right now, and really September, October is the main time. Different birds move at different times of the year. So if you're looking for yellow warblers and nighthawks, you're pretty much too late. The yellow warbler departed already as we're getting into August. The last 2 weeks, the nighthawks are moving through. As we talked about, orioles, hummingbirds are getting ready to go. Canada geese, the migrants haven't even shown up yet, though the local nesting birds are there. But you'll see the succession of birds over the next 2 months as we've got different species coming and going. It's always an exciting time of the year.
Oh, I love it over there. And there are so many nice places to walk and see the birds over there. I just love going there.
You've got the auto tour route on the north end. Highway 49 is always popular. A number of different overlooks along the east side, on the south end, on the state portion, series of trails there in the education center. The problem is, of course, you've got a big wetland, and you're kind of watching from the sides. If you're looking for something exciting, canoeing in the state portion is available as well.
Yeah.
And I would recommend that over the next 3 weeks. Great time to do it, because after that, the duck season opens up, and you'll have the hunters there early in the morning.
And you mentioned... You mentioned nighthawks.
There you go. A little buzzy call. It's all it is. It's a relative to the whippoorwill. It's in a group of birds called the goatsuckers.
Huh?
Kind of an odd name for it. It comes from an old myth. But they're very large insect eaters.
Yeah.
It's a population that has seriously declined in Wisconsin. I remember 25 years ago, over the cities of Fond du Lac, West Bend, Sheboygan, they were nesting on the roofs of the buildings and feeding right over the city lights. But as we've gone to more of that black tar and plastic roof that got too hot for the eggs along Lake Michigan, we know the gulls have increased and there's nest predation. And there may be something even going on in the food chain. Contaminants or perhaps problems in this, the wintering ground. We're not quite sure, but it seems like most of the nesting is in northern Wisconsin and into Canada now. But always those couple of weeks in August, we get a big movement, always right around sunset people see them. And I saw a report just a week ago, somebody said hundreds and hundreds over by La Crosse area. There are a couple of really good sightings. I got to see a number of smaller flocks moving through. And as we get to this first part of September, the tail end, you may catch a few yet, but the main passage of nighthawks just went through Wisconsin.
And Laura sent us a nice photo of while she was kayaking in the Sheboygan Marsh State Wildlife Area yesterday. Osprey?
Yes, osprey.
Beautiful in flight.
Another bird that was on the endangered list and has come back in Wisconsin. It is not as abundant or widespread as the bald eagle, but it certainly is much more prevalent than it was, say, 20 years ago.
Gus in Fitchburg, your turn. Hi, Gus.
Hi, Bill and Larry. Great show. Yeah, I'm a civil engineer, and I really get into maps, and I know that the Peterson Field Guide has had some excellent maps, but I'm wondering with the new tracking techniques that you have you seen big changes in the maps that have been published, and who makes those maps anyway?
Oh, good question. Well, like the Peterson and other field guides, those are somewhat generalized from bird observations. And so, for example, we talked earlier in the program about yellow-headed blackbird. They'll show a big area in all of southern Wisconsin where that bird might occur, but it's specialized in the deep water marshes, so it's actually more punctuated of where we find it and a lot of places in between where it doesn't occur. We're seeing much more refined maps because of eBird, the electronic bird checklist. And now from birder observations all over the United States, we're getting some really refined ones of where these birds occur and how these change throughout the year as these birds are moving. We always will see changes in bird populations, too, in response to changes in the quality of the environment and available habitat. So bald eagles and ospreys declined with the DDT. They've made a tremendous comeback. We talked earlier about bobolinks, changes in land use practices, changing agricultural practices, or creating CRP set-aside. Grassland birds will come and go with that. And we've also seen the expansion over the decades of cardinals moving further north, red-bellied woodpeckers, tufted titmice. they're moving. And we'll also see what climate change may also affect certain bird populations. So mapping is important, and certainly with the sophistication these days becoming much more detailed and refined, we'll also be tracking the changes. A big project right now is the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, and observers are out there looking very fine, kind of a grid system of Wisconsin of where birds are nesting throughout the summer season. And this is now going to be a 20-year follow-up, so we'll also not see where the birds are nesting now, but changes that have happened for these birds. So we've got a couple more field seasons, and they'll publish those results.
And in the meantime, though, you can go on to look at some mapping of that.
Yes, that's all eBird.
All eBird.
So everybody's entering their data electronically for the Atlas as well as their own daily sightings. So, yeah, if you go to eBird, you can spend a lot of time out there on the computer looking at bird sightings and records. And, of course, as I say, one of the big things will be changes and how are these birds doing.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Jim in Osceola, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I learned to watch birds from my fifth grade teacher in Milwaukee in the 1950s. And although I'm not active, I'm still always aware of the birds that are around me. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if the birding population is aging or are new birders coming up?
Good question. I think we see this in bird watchers and even in some of the other nature type organizations. I do a lot of speaking to Audubon groups and at nature centers. And yeah, it tends to be somewhat of an older audience. There is a concern there that kids are getting a little more distant from the outdoors. There was a wonderful book published a number of years ago called Last Child in the Woods. And the what they refer to as nature deficit disorder, that essentially kids are just so removed from nature, which means are they sensitive to even environmental issues, much less do they have contact with nature. And birding is certainly a very accessible way. There are some good things. I mean, certainly kids today have more and more distractions and more opportunities or options of things to do with their time. And a lot of that is in front of some sort of a screen rather than outdoors. But for those who are interested, there are just so many more tools out there to learn about birds and to be able to do this on your own, much less to link up with a nature center and go somewhere. And so, yeah, it's encouraging. There are some kids who are getting out there and learning very quickly, being some just crack birders. But also for, I think, kids in general, the vast majority of them that seem to be drawn to other things. And this is a really important outlet for so many reasons, not just to even be aware that birds are there and that they are a great indicator of the healthy environment, but it's healthy for them to get outside and just have some contact with that natural world. And to me, nothing is more easily done or more accessible than watching birds.
I just not long ago had a couple of youngsters on, or one youngster who had started a bird club, birding club at West High School and in Madison, and it kind of goes along with what you were talking about.
And that also brings up one last thought here, and that's one of the problems is that as that audience ages, the younger kids who do have their own personal interest in birds sometimes feel that they just don't fit in with, you know, people who are old enough to be their parents and grandparents. So they feel a little out of place. They want to be with somebody of their own peers. And so these youth clubs would be really important. Get them and their friends interested, not have them feel like some outsider in an adult group.
Well, Patsy sent us a photo and says, I hope this little guy finds a home before winter.
Oh, he's out.
A parakeet.
Yeah, you got a parakeet there. Somebody's escapee.
Somebody's escapee. And I wanted to also, before we go back to the phones, Greg sent a video of a ruby-throated hummingbird. Let's see if I can get it going
here. Yeah, very nice. On its nest, and very typical nest, about as big around as a quarter.
Yeah,
and all made of a little spider web, fine plant down, and then glued to the side are lichens.
Yeah.
They are really hard to find, those little nests. So great sighting, and on top of that, he's got some great footage. That's a young bird there. You see the slightly shorter beak, and he's just trying his wings.
Yeah, that's a...
So he's trying to get up there. He'll probably be gone in a day or two from when he shot that.
Let's go. That's a very cool video.
Yeah, again, very nice find.
Visitor post. Beautiful. On our Facebook page. Let's go to Robin in Portage. Robin, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I know it's late so quickly. I finally saw my first sighting this year of the pileated woodpecker, if I'm pronouncing that properly. Mm-hmm.
Both are acceptable, pileated or pileated.
Okay. Anyway, what I live in, right in the city of Portage, mm-hmm. and on two sides of me, I'm surrounded by woods and then marsh on below one woods. Anyway, I have had the pileated woodpecker for probably about 15 years ago is when I first sighted them,
mm-hmm.
and I have seen one baby. But I'm just wondering about the history. Are they still on the endangered list? What's the scoop?
Good question. Actually, they never were on the endangered list in Wisconsin. Populations are fairly widespread. They're doing pretty well. They seem to be pretty stable. It's not a migratory bird, so it's a year-round resident. They do need, however, a pretty extensive woodlot or forested area and also mature trees. The good news is that in some parts of our state, as the trees are maturing and forests are regrowing, they're actually providing some really good pileated habitat. So where I live, the Northern Kettle Moraine Forest, I've been seeing over the last 30 years an actual increase there.
Yeah.
And across areas of northern Wisconsin as well. So it's a somewhat solitary bird and somewhat secretive, even for his big size. So it's a chance encounter.
Yeah.
But it is always a great sighting. Beautiful bird.
Thank you, Robin, for calling. Janie in Nakusa, your turn. Hi, Janie. Do you have a quick question
Hi,
for
Mary.
Us?
Hi, Mary. Please don't ever retire.
Okay.
You have such a wonderful show. My question is, are there any birds that have ever been tracked to Europe or the other way, to Africa? Or
mm-hmm.
are there any birds that would migrate that far?
Across the ocean.
Actually, yes. Especially in the eastern United States, we've had periodic reports of fieldfare, which is their thrush, the corncrake, which is the European counterpart to our sora rail. Some of these birds have actually crossed over from northern Europe into the eastern United States. Sandpipers are long-distance migrants. We'll occasionally get the European ruff that'll show up. So some of these have been known to cross over. The more likely spot, a lot of people who are keeping a North American bird list go way to the very tip of the Aleutian Islands because it still is North America, but they're just slipping over a small strait from Siberia to add some unusual birds there. We've also found, for example, that even small songbirds like Kinetic Warbler with recent studies of geotags will gather on the eastern United States and shoot over the ocean and go all the way down to Brazil nonstop. So some of these birds that have these long flights are not only extraordinary in what they can do, but if they catch the wrong wind, they may end up in the wrong place, too. So, yes, occasionally they will. And so it is possible. And I think that's what makes bird watching so interesting is there's always those seasonal trends of things that we expect to see. And then there's something that we just don't.
So there we go. Thank you so much, Janie, for calling. And Bill, as always, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for being with us. You'll come back and do this again, I hope.
Anytime you ask, Larry. Thanks. My pleasure. It's a great way to spend a holiday.
Oh, man. Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. He worked at the Horican Marsh for 27 years, been watching birds for over 40 years, and has sighted more than 3,600 species. Part of that, it was a round-the-world trip that he took with his wife and in order to be able to see and count all those birds. Well, tomorrow we'll be talking with Wisconsin author Michael Edmonds about his new book, The Wisconsin Capital. I've read it. It's really a fun read. So join us for that. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.